G'day everybody, welcome back to the Birders Guide. Today I've got a guest on who is not Australian. The second one I said back when I interviewed Nate Swick, couldn't even tell you what episode that was, that I was hoping to every now and then do an episode with someone who wasn't Australian, but to also keep once a fortnight doing Australian guests, because I think that's, that is definitely my focus. So anyway, I'd like to shout out to Woods Lane Publishing, who sent me a copy of the book that we're talking about today, and also a shout out to Swarovski Optic for supporting the show. I'm not going to talk too much about this beforehand. I'm not going to do a spiel. I'll just do my usual introduction in a couple of days' time when the normal one comes out. As I said, I got this book from Woods Lane Publishing, and I found it quite fascinating. It was a really good read. I would recommend buying it and reading it. But I got in touch with Vernon, who was the author, and asked if he'd be interested in coming on and having a chat, which he agreed to. So here we are. So anyway, that's all I've got to say about it. Let's get into it.
You're listening to The Birder's Guide with Michael Greenshields.
So, Vernon, welcome to the Birder's Guide. It's great to have you on the show.
It's wonderful to be here, and welcome and hello to all your listeners.
Now, which I'm sure people have picked up from your accent, you're not from Australia. Whereabouts are you based in the world?
Yes, indeed. I'm pretty far away from Australia. I'm kind of on the other end of the world, at the tip of Africa. I live in Cape Town. South Africa.
Have you always lived in Cape Town?
I'm born here. I was born in a little bungalow at the sea in a place called Clifton. So I grew up literally on the beach watching seabirds.
Oh, yeah, nice. I was in Cape Town in 2015, I think, for not very long, maybe a week or so, with my wife. So my wife is South African. She moved out when she was 10, so she's more Australian, but originally South African. And we went back to see her grandparents after we got married and spent a week in Cape Town. It's really pretty. I think Kirsten Bosch is probably one of my favorite botanic gardens in the world that I've been to. But maybe that was just because all the birds were new to me when I was there.
Look, I mean, I must agree with you. Kirsten Bosch is a very special place, and it's certainly one of my favorite places to watch birds in Cape Town. And it's, as you say, it's full of all these endemic species that seem to live in and around our fynbos biome, which is a very special habitat type. So we've got lots of endemic species on land here, and then we've got a fantastic coastline and lots of seabirds, and we get wonderful migratory species coming every summer from the Palearctic, so a great spot for waders. It's altogether a fantastic birding destination.
Mm, yeah. What's, around Cape Town, what's the top three or four species that people are coming to try and find? Do you have any like Cape Town specific endemics? Anything that is that?
Okay, yeah. Interesting question. We don't have a specific Cape Town endemic, but if you look at Cape Town, which is on this peninsula, I would say within sort of 100 kilometers from center of Cape Town, if one did a sort of a radius, we've got fantastic endemic species that you can see in a day. And probably number one on the list is the Cape Rockjumper. There are only two species in the family. They both occur in South Africa. So it's an endemic South African genus, actually, and family. And there's the Cape Rockjumper and the Drakensberg Rockjumper. And in fact, this year, the Cape Rockjumper is declared South Africa's Bird of the Year. We choose a Bird of the Year every year. And the Cape Rockjumper has claimed the crown for this year. So we're promoting it. And of course, it's a symbol of a very special habitat and of the Cape, very much a Cape bird. So it's certainly, that's probably number one in terms of endemics. Then we've got things like Cape Siskin. We've got the fantastic orange-breasted sunbird, which is possibly South Africa's most beautiful sunbird, and in my opinion, Africa's most beautiful sunbird. And there are a number of other fantastic species. There's lots of stuff here.
Yeah. What's the penguins that you can see on, what's the island? Oh, what's Robben Island off of Cape Town?
Right. Absolutely. So Africa has one species of penguin, one species of indigenous penguin, which is the African penguin.
There you go.
aptly named. It's really, really, really threatened. I mean, it's a critically endangered species. I mean, from 2 million pairs, we're down to sort of 20,000 pairs in the world. So BirdLife South Africa, the organization I sit on the board of, is trying to save the species. And Robben Island is one of the places you can still see it. But there's a huge problem with food for these seabirds. There's overfishing and all kinds of things going on, and one's got to be careful about that. But the fishing industry has come to the party and is really assisting, trying to resolve the matter. It's a real team effort across the board, from industry through to the ornithological community and the birding community. We're all trying to work together, which is a wonderful success story, actually. Just in that camaraderie of spirit.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that you were on the board of BirdLife South Africa. Are birds your career? What do you do for a job? Do you still work? Are you retired?
It's a very good question. I wish I was retired, because then all I would do is watch birds. But I wear a few hats. I'm an architect, so I design houses, and I design houses so that I can go and watch birds all over the world. But I also started writing books about my experiences with birds. I wrote the first one in 2014. It came out in 2015, and that has opened up a new career for me as a writer. And I write books about birds. So I sort of spend half the year writing and traveling, and the rest of the year designing the odd building. And that's what I do.
Yeah, nice. So how did you get into birding?
It's a good question. I actually tackle it in this book that you're going to talk to me about just now, my first book. But essentially, my grandfather had a farm on the outskirts of the city of Johannesburg in the Gauteng region of South Africa. In fact, it's now no longer a farm. It's all city and shopping centers and things. But 40 years ago, when I was a little boy of six, my grandfather used to take me for walks in the early morning on the farm in the mist. And the first bird I ever heard and saw was a bird that I had to cultivate in my mind, because in the mist, I just heard this doo 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 call. And he said to me, while holding my hand, he said, "That's the call of the rainbird." And I was able to sort of imagine what it looked like, you know. And when you're a little boy, your imagination does fantastic things. And as the mist lifted, on top of this bush was this huge cuckoo species with these bright red shining eyes making this call. And he said, "That's the rainbird." And it was the first bird I ever attached a name to. And that was the beginning of my birding. From then on, I wanted to know the names of all the birds that were on the farm and all the birds that were back at my home. And since then, the rainbird became Birchall's cuckoo. And I haven't stopped listing birds since I was about six or seven.
There you go. So how do you get from being a six-year-old boy chasing rainbirds to being part of an expedition to find basically species new to science?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's kind of the reason I wrote that book, because I needed to tell the story of what it means to be a bird watcher. I needed to understand for myself why I watch birds, and I needed to share that love and passion with other people and tell them why they should watch birds, because watching birds has shaped my entire life. Watching birds has been the road that I've been able to navigate, and watching birds has shown me the world. It's introduced me to people. I have friends and memories that have all been created through watching birds. And it started with that simple act of a little boy being shown birds by his grandfather. And it was really a powerful gift he gave me. And it's a gift that I hope I can pass on to children across the world. And that's a connection with nature. Mm. That's for children to actually go outside and listen and look and explore and find this wonderful world of nature, which so many children don't even know exists. They're so caught up with cell phones and iPhones and iPads and laptops and computer games and social media that they're forgetting to go outside and look and listen and ask questions and touch the earth and play out in nature. And if we as birders can try and just instill in them what we were given by our friends and parents and those before us, I think Michael, that's the future of both bird watching and conservation on this planet.
And I think you did a good job of explaining that in your book, because your book is about, well, as the title says, it's about chasing down the rarest bird in the world. But I would say that probably, it's been a couple of months since I've read it, but let's say 50% of the book is not necessarily about the story of the chase. It's about birding and you and rarity and commonplaceness and all the stuff that comes with birding. And so I think you do a good job of explaining that. So maybe we won't get into that. We'll get back into that if we have time at the end, but I doubt we will.
Right. No problem. You can have me back again some other time if you need to.
I was going to say, we'll have to get you back on and talk about your other books and all the other stuff.
No problem.
Now, do you want to explain to everyone listening how, what's the question? So this whole thing came about, there was a wing that was found. What was the story with the wing?
I tell you what I'll do. I'll just read this little blurb on the back of the book because it kind of sets the picture nicely. Can I do that?
Yeah, yep.
In 1990, a group of University of Cambridge scientists arrived at the plains of Nechisar, tucked between the hills of the Great Rift Valley in Ethiopia. On that expedition, they collected 23 species of small mammals, a rodent, a bat, 315 species of birds were seen, 69 species of butterfly, and 20 species of dragonflies and damselflies were identified. 17 reptile species were recorded, 3 frog species were filed, plants were listed, and the wing of an unidentified bird was packed into a brown paper bag. And that's where my story began, really, with that expedition all those many years ago. Because 22 years later, after that expedition, I was invited on an expedition to go and look for the wing, or perhaps the rest of the bird that might have been attached to that wing, at that very place in southern Ethiopia. And I was invited by the great birder, Ian Sinclair.
Oh, yeah.
The Gill Memorial Medalist for African Ornithology, a dear friend of mine who's shown me the birds of Africa on many different expeditions, and we've traveled all over the world together. He phoned me up and said, "Vern, I have a map with an X that marks the spot." I mean, it doesn't get more exciting than that, Mike. I mean, it's like out of the movies, you know. It's like those boys' own tales that we read about when we're little. But when South Africa and Africa's greatest birder phones you up and says, "I have a map with an X that marks the spot of the rarest bird in the world. No one's ever seen it. Do you want to go?"
It's hardly a question.
Hardly a question that needs an answer. Yeah. So I picked myself up off the floor and said, "When are we leaving? I'm at the front door." And it wasn't too many months later, after we'd planned the expedition, because it was a self-funded expedition, 4 of us met in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. Ian and I flew in from South Africa. He also lives in Cape Town. Jerry Nichols flew in from America, from Connecticut. And Dennis Weir flew in from Ireland. And the 4 of us hired an old 4x4 and headed south into those famous rift valleys of southern Ethiopia to one of the most remote places on the planet.
So can you explain to us what the Netjeshwar Plain, what does that actually, what's that look like? How big is it?
Let me explain it to you, because it needs to be captured in words for your listeners. It's, as I said, one of the most remote places on the planet. The plain falls within the Netjeshwar National Park, a protected area in southern Ethiopia, and it's on the African Rift Valley system, which is a strange fault line that is very active at the moment. It's separating at about 6 centimeters a year. So in about 10 million years, there's going to be a new ocean between Somalia and the rest of Africa, which will be where the Rift Valley crack is at the moment. So it's an active area, active volcanoes, active part of the world in terms of the geomorphology. And to get up into and onto this plain, you have to drive along a strange isthmus, which is this sort of little peninsula between these two crater lakes. And the one crater lake is bright blue and the other one is brown. And the one has the world's biggest crocodiles and the other the world's biggest hippopotami. And you're in the middle of nowhere and you've got to negotiate this treacherous pass, and you end up on this plain up in the middle of nowhere that hardly anybody, except for the local tribes, have ever explored. It's really not been explored much by science. I mean, we were one of the few expeditions to go in there after the wing had been found. And of course, we went in there illegally, because you weren't really allowed onto these planes at night at all. So we hired guys with machine guns, and up we went, because it was a bit of a treacherous place. People shoot each other up there. And we went up there in the middle of the night to look for this Netjeshwar nightjar, which is a night bird, of course. And that's where our story began.
So what other nightjars are present there? Are there any other ones? Like, if you found one, was that definitely going to be the one you were looking for?
Yeah, look, I mean, Africa's full of nightjars, as you know, and Ethiopia is full of them. What was interesting is, you know, we'd seen a lot of the nightjar species in Africa. We know all the calls of all the nightjars as a team. We know all the wing patterns of all the nightjars, males and females, because they like fingerprints, and where the markings are on the open wings and tails when they fly around and display, you're able to identify them just on that and on their call. I mean, that's a given for all the nightjars in Africa. But this one, obviously, all we had to go on was a wing. And it was the wing of a male, as it happened, we think. So we knew what to look for in terms of a wing pattern. Obviously, we didn't have a call because the thing has never been seen before. And we would know immediately if it was something different, because we'd seen we know the other nightjars. And the most dominant species of a nightjar up there at that time of the year was Donaldson Smith's nightjar, which is a very small little nightjar. They were all over the place. So we were prepared in that sense, as best as we could be, knowing what to look for. And we had to either catch one of these things or photograph it or something, because there was no other way of identifying it. As I say, the call was unknown.
You obviously got a look at this wing before you left.
Yeah, I know. It was studied. I mean, it was drawn, studied, looked at in the Tring Museum in England. We knew this thing extremely well, it just happens to be a very big wing. It's a huge nightjar wing. I mean, it's a big white patch almost on the carpal joint. It looks like a damn skewer, but it was a very interesting bird. I mean, we were hoping to see it, but perhaps what I could just, I don't know, Michael, should I explain a little bit about how it came to be regarded as the rarest bird in the world, or is that something we're going to get to later? Because
nope, go ahead.
It's sort of fundamental to the quest. You know, why go all the way to southern Ethiopia to look for something that no one's ever seen? Well, the thing is this. What is the rarest bird in the world? Well, we suggest, and I propose in this book, it's the only bird nobody's ever seen. Because there is a bird that people have seen once. There are a number of species of birds people have seen once, and they kind of know that there might be one or two or 10 of them around. But when there's a bird that's described to science that nobody's ever seen, it's only been collected once by one wing in one tiny locality in some strange place that virtually no one from the scientific community has ever been to, could it indeed be described as the rarest bird in the world? And if we saw one of these birds flying just once, would we have seen the rarest bird in the world? That was the sort of romantic question we asked ourselves and the romantic quest we were on. Mm. And I unpack in the book, of course, what rarity means, what commonness means, what are the rarest birds in the world. You know, is there a list of top 10? Is the list constantly changing? Do we call rare birds rare because we split them into new species? And I try and look at what's very rare and what's very common and what rarity means. What does it mean about conserving the environment, conserving habitats? Are these greatly endangered species indeed the last ambassadors of the pristine? Are they the last birds that tell us, listen, we have to look after this forest or that plain? And these were the exciting things that buzzed through my head. Not when I was looking for this bird. I just wanted to stay alive when I was doing that. But when I got home, I thought, I've got to tell a story about all of this stuff, because all of these thoughts and ideas were rushing through my head when I got home. And I wanted to tell people about rarity. And then, of course, I wanted to tell them about common things, because we've got to keep the common common. Anyway, I can go on and on. So, yeah. But, I mean, I can get into the adventure a little bit for your listeners and tell them about the physical landscape of the place, because that might be really exciting. But I can tell you one thing. I'd never held an AK-47 rifle before. And I'd never been on a plane where people come over the hill and they've got spears in the one hand and AK-47 rifles in the other. And they want to know what I'm doing on their plane, because that's where they have fought territorial battles for their cows to be fed. And then we had to explain, we're actually there to look for a bird. And when we explained the bird, we had to only explain it by wing, because we couldn't really tell them what the rest of it looked like. And they looked at us as if we were completely nuts.
Maybe you were completely nuts.
Michael, you know what us bird watchers are like. I mean, I have friends who've disappeared in forests and never come back. And of course, we know the stories of people eaten by tigers and disappearing left, right, and center. Us bird watchers are an interesting breed. And there is an edge to bird watching that might be called an extreme sport. But it's something we do because we love nature. We want to get out there. We want to get out in the middle of it. And the thing about looking at a bird is once you look at the bird, you start seeing everything else. You start seeing the butterflies. You start wanting to know about the trees. You want to know about this sort of interconnectivity of nature. And that's the joy of birds. It tells this fantastic story of wilderness. So, you know, we're out there, to get back to it, driving up onto this plain. And it's this just fantastic sort of volcanic, crumbled volcanic pebbles and rocks, and there are these white grasses growing in between them. And that white grass is called Nechisa. That's the Amharic word for white grass. And that's where the name of that plain came from, the Nechisa Plain. And then, of course, the Nechisa Nightjar was found right in the middle of it. And, I never forget that first afternoon. We're in the middle of the plain. We're standing next to this little tree. Now, I must say, you know, there's lions and things around. You've got to keep your eyes open. But there were none within any close distance. And lions aren't common in Ethiopia anymore these days. But we're standing on this plain, and the sun is going down. The nightjars are starting to call. And we're at the spot where this wing had been found squashed in the mud all those 22 years previously. And our minds are doing what bird watchers' minds do. They start, you know, imagining what birds are going to look like, and they're imagining, you know, that your next lifer might just be the rarest bird in the world.
Mm.
It's quite a nice feeling for a bird watcher, let me tell you.
Yeah. So how big is the plane?
Oh, you know, it's not too big. I mean, I can't give you, it's possibly, I mean, I don't know, 5-10 kilometers across. You know, in the distance, you see these mountains, these volcanic mountains rising up, and they rise up into these juniper forests where, you know, who knows what's out there. And you're surrounded by volcanoes. You feel like you're in a lost world. You really feel like you're in a lost world. You see nothing except distant lakes, and you're surrounded by wild animals and the calls of birds and beautiful butterflies. I mean, you know, as we drove, just to backtrack, to get onto this strange kind of bridge, they call it the bridge of heaven between the two lakes, to get onto that, before you even get into the mountains and onto the plain, you've got to drive through a rainforest. But there's no road in this rainforest, so we're going to drive up the riverbed. And we drove up the riverbed, and as we drove, the salts that had collected in the ponds on the sides were filled with tens of thousands of butterflies of all different colors, bursts of purple, bursts of white, bursts of blue, and they'd scatter up like these clouds of sort of wings in the rainforest with the light falling on them. And you drive through that, and you look up at these colobus monkeys dancing in the canopy. You hear birds you haven't seen before, incredible species, and you know you're on a journey you'll never forget.
Mm.
And of course, best of all, you're with your three best mates. You have great fun together because, of course, we know that bird watching is about sharing birds with other people too. It's about being with friends. It's about making new friends. But we were, you know, driving through in this old rusty 4x4 up through all of that, and then heading up onto the plain to be there at dusk so we could listen for the nightjars.
So you're sitting up on the plane. It's the sun is starting to set. What did you do from sort of there until, I don't know, did you look all night? Was it, how did you actually try and find this bird?
Right. Now, Michael, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but
you tell what you want to tell. That's fine.
Yes. But I have to tell you that we had to make more than one trip onto that plane at night. Because on our first evening, as we got ready to begin looking for nightjars, and we started hearing Donaldson Smith nightjars calling all over the place, and we started seeing them. You know, they flutter like giant moths. And we got our nightjar detecting equipment ready because after years of experimentation and after looking at nightjars all over the world, we had developed the most sophisticated technology known to man for the discovery of rare nightjars. And that equipment, of course, is the torch. And now you get torches and then you get torches. And, you know, these days, many years later, I mean, I've got a torch that could probably be used on a space shuttle of some sort. I mean, it's really high-tech stuff. And it goes in my pocket. But back then, we had to fashion a special nightjar spotting torch that would have the great beam length and width and power to detect nightjars across this plain. And Ian Sinclair had fashioned such a fantastic device, which was this giant spotlight, which he connected with a long piece of cord and flex to the cigarette lighter in the middle of this old 4x4, and of course we would turn on the engine and the light would sort of explode out onto the plane, and it was a handheld torch, and we'd stand on the seats, and I would scan back and forth looking for nightjars, and as we plugged it in. And the damn thing exploded, Michael, like Guy Fawkes fireworks itself.
Mm.
And that was the end of our high-tech equipment.
Yeah, not many repair shops out there.
Not too many, my friend, not at all. And we had to then resort to our other spotlights, which we could also operate as backup. And they were fantastic devices, and they did work, to be honest. But they were no match on our great initial plan. But, you know, there was so much insect activity in the sky, and we'd chosen a time of year that we thought would be perfect for nightjars, and this seemed to be it. There were insects everywhere. And of course, if you're holding a spotlight, you're a magnet for every insect in Africa. And these things came flying in from all sizes. And tropical Africa is full of insects the size of bloody 4x4s, let me tell you. And these things all came to the proximity, and I would say within 2 or 3 centimeters of the proximity of the light. And that's where my mouth and eyes happened to be, because I was the one on light duty because I was the youngest. Mm-hmm. The others sat in their seats with their binoculars. So I must have eaten about 3 or 4 kilograms of insects that evening. And I mean, these things went up my nose and in my ears, and my shirt filled up with them. But I was dedicated to my role, and I scanned for nightjars. And we scanned and scanned, and we saw some exciting things out there, Michael. Exciting things. Your listeners are going to have to read my book to see exactly what we did see.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to also understand that we had to go back the next night, because we went back to a village to fashion what we regard as the greatest nightjar catching net the world has ever seen. And we did embark on such a quest, and such a net was made, Michael. It was like a giant jousting stick that stuck out from the front of our 4x4. It was the longer than any pool net you'll ever find, my friend. And you can guess who had to hold it. Yes, that would be me once again. A torch in my one hand and a nightjar catching net that weighed about a ton in the other.
We'll leave the story there. People can buy the book if they want to go any further there. But I did have a question about this wing, which I feel might be a question that other people would think. Has anybody done a DNA analysis on it just to make sure that it's not like an anomaly of like a normal nightjar or anything like that?
It's a very important question. And it's the first question I asked when Ian Sinclair phoned me and he had a map that had an X that marks the spot. I said, Ian, I need to ask you a delicate question, because I know you like to split species, and I'm not going halfway across the world to look for a nightjar that could be just another nightjar because it's from a valley across the way.
Mm-hmm.
He said, my boy, it's in the field guide for the birds of sub-Saharan Africa for a reason. If you open it to page whatever it is, you'll see a picture of all the nightjars, and you'll see a picture of just a wing. That's our bird. And I said, fair enough, that's great, but I need to ask you a technical question. Has DNA work been done on it? He said, absolutely. It was taken to the Museum of Tring. DNA work was done on it. A paper was prepared and submitted to IBIS, which is one of the most important ornithological journals in the world. And ornithologists and nitro experts from around the world analyzed the paper, and it was declared a good species, Caprimulgus solala, solus meaning only, ala meaning wing, only one wing. And it was described to science as a good and solid species, unlike any other nightjar the world has ever known. Mm. So that question was answered very quickly for me, Michael. And it remains a good species. It's on the birds of the world list. It's in the bird life, you know, it's in the ornithological, the International Ornithological Association's list of birds, etc. It's there. It's a good species. Nechisar nightjar. And it certainly does exist. And we'll leave it there on that point. But I hope that answers your question. It's a big wing too. Massive nightjar wing.
Would you recommend other people go and try and find it? Because I'm just thinking people might be listening to this and think, oh, I might go have a crack at that. Is that
yes, go for it.
Good idea.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm coming with them. Now, look, there was an expedition that went up there a few years back, 5 or 6 years ago. I think it was a Dutch team of ornithologists that went up there. They couldn't find the Nitrosol nightjar, but they had a completely different suite of nightjars up there to the suite of nightjars we had, which makes me think that things change on that plane at different times of the year. And I'm of the view that these kinds of places might involve regional sort of migration of species, altitudinal migration even. Birds move around in Africa like that, and perhaps this nightjar is one of those.
Yeah.
So there's lots of mysteries still to be unraveled, but I reckon these planes and this plane needs to be explored much more. And I actually chatted to a team of filmmakers who wanted to do something for the BBC and actually take me back there and make a movie. It didn't happen. There were budget restraints and stuff, but I'd be very keen on a team going back there and maybe making a film.
Well, let me know. I'll come along.
Yeah, I'll let you know, my friend, for sure. We need an Australian on the crew.
Yeah, I'll be there. So you wrote, as I said earlier, your book's about 50% this trip, 50% other stuff about birding. So what do you have any thoughts on everything else that you wrote?
Yes, I do. And I try and take the reader on a journey of looking at other nightjars, actually, to kind of set the context of the Nitrosol nightjar. And you know, you got nightjars, and you got the other groups of birds that belong to the same sort of nightjar family. So you've got these ancient birds like potus in the New World, and a bird called the oil bird, which I saw in Venezuela, which is even possibly the most ancient of that lineage. And I take the reader on journeys to look for these species as a sort of a build-up to going to look for a nightjar in Africa. And I actually also even share the story of the first nightjar I ever saw, which was a fiery-necked nightjar, and what it means to see birds of the night. And as a birder, what it means to look at birds at dusk and to listen to their calls and to try and identify them from call, and why nightjars are so sort of mystical and mythical for me, and how indeed nightjars are part of sort of birding law and almost cultural law, and how the first nightjars that were ever described to science in Europe, for example, the European nightjar, was called the goat sucker. That was its common name, because it was sort of a bird that lived on the edge of the village, on the edge of the field, on the edge of town, and it sort of fluttered around in dusk, and it had all kinds of kind of haunting qualities to it. And they called them goat suckers because they thought they hang from the teats of goats and cows at night, drinking their milk. And you know, these mythical stories about birds build up in your mind. And you know, so nightjars tell stories of ancient sort of birding interactions, of ancient connections with nature, of the edge of a village where it becomes the forest. Nightjars tell stories that birders absorb, and these stories become part of tradition and part of birding now. And so when I saw my first nightjar, it was that mystical, mystical feeling of birding at dusk. And I mean, we all love looking at owls. We love owls because they look beautiful, but we love owls because we have to find them at night and they've got calls and that torchlight goes on them and then there's something different. And night birding is a big part of birding. It's as exciting as forest birding, which is a different kind of way of seeing nature. It's like being out on the Southern Ocean in these huge swells and looking at albatrosses. It's a different kind of birding again. But it's all about interacting with nature in these different ways. So I take birders on my interactions with birds and night birds and other birds too, to try and make them understand what was pulling me towards looking for the rarest bird in the world.
So what's your plans now, sort of moving forwards? You mentioned before, I think it was before we started recording, that you've just written another book. Do you have any more writing plans or?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. I mean, I'm another of my books that came out, which I highly recommend to your listeners, is a book called Featherings. It's a collection of short stories by Africa's greatest birders and ornithologists and even just everyday bird watchers. I was asked by my publisher to edit this collection, where I asked each person to tell me about their most precious birding story. So in this collection, you'll hear a story of literally Africa's greatest birders and ornithologists, and you'll hear about someone finding the Congo peacock, and you'll hear about someone else on some southern ocean island finding the world's rarest rail, or you'll hear about another birder who was about to be kidnapped by rebels in Central Africa, and you'll hear about a birder who proposed to his wife at the sewage works, and you'll hear about, you know, all these interesting stories about birders and birding. And that's a collection of about 24 stories. And all the funds from that book go to the Fitzpatrick Institute of African Ornithology at the University of Cape Town. I sit on the board of that university's particular institute. And all the funds go towards ornithological research. So tell your listeners to buy a book called Featherings. It all goes towards science. Lovely stories. And then my next book that came out, which was a fiction story, a story about, based on my travels up and down the Congo River, where I saw a swallow that is new to science. And all I did was see it, Michael. I glimpsed it. I didn't have time to photograph it, and I've gone back to look for it, but it was too dangerous, so I had to leave. I have to go back again and look for this damn swallow. It's a strange thing. But because I only saw the swallow, I had to write a fictional novel about a bird watcher who lives in Congo, and he has a passion to grow a tree. And he wants to grow a tree for various reasons. Maybe to bring nature back into the city, maybe to commemorate his dead friend who was killed by lightning in a tree, and also because he just loves to watch birds. And he wants to make gardens in the city and watch birds and find this strange swallow. So that's this fictional book. It's called A Tree for the Birds. I don't know if your listeners will see this, but there it is. It's available over the world. And then I've wrote a poetry collection because I love birds so much. They inspire poems. I mean, what am I supposed to do? my wife shakes her head. She married a poet, Michael. Can you believe it? But then, of course, I'm busy with a new book now, because I fell in love with writing so much. I went back to university, and I'm busy with a master's degree in writing. Mm. And this new book is about the sea, and it's about a damn seagull. In fact, the seagull speaks, Michael. But it's going to be a book about what it means to live on the edge of the land and the sea, and why bird watchers love to be on the coast. But that's what I'm busy with now, and hopefully that'll be out at the end of the year. I'll let you know. I'll send you a copy, mate.
Yeah, nice.
So that's what I'm busy with.
I've just got one more question that I'll ask before we wrap up. And so I ask this question of everybody who comes on the show. This is Australian questions, but for you, this is a, let's go, South Africa. So of everywhere that you, let me rephrase that. If someone was coming to South Africa for one day, they had 24 hours, where should they go birding?
It's a very good question, Michael. Now, obviously, I'm biased because I live in Cape Town, so I'd like them to come here and see our fynbos endemics. So I'm going to err on the side of caution and say Cape Town, because you can do pelagic birds, fynbos birds, and all the migratory stuff in one day, and probably get like 150 species, right? And lots of endemics. But I have to do a proviso, Michael, and you have to allow me to also say the Kruger National Park, because the Kruger National Park is a place where you can see a splash of wild Africa in one go. Mm. From the comfort of a vehicle, you can see all kinds of species of incredible birds. You'll see some endemics, but you'll see all kinds of wild African stuff too. Lions, leopards, elephants, and everything else. And it's a unique experience if you've never been to Africa before. If you've been to Africa before, come to Cape Town, see the fynbos endemics, see the penguins, see the stuff up the west coast, and go to Cape Point and then do a pelagic all in one day.
Well, hopefully people will come visit you in Cape Town.
Yes, man. We'd love to have them. We've got a bird club here. They'll take them out. We've got fantastic birding guides, professionals that will help them. We've got lots of stuff. And next time you come to Cape Town, you let me know, mate.
I will. I will certainly do that. Well, Vernon, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for giving us some of, well, I think it's morning there or about lunchtime now. Thanks for giving us some time. And it's great to hear your enthusiasm. And maybe we'll get back in touch in a little while and we can talk about some of your other books.
Yes, please call me anytime. I'm there to chat. Lots to talk about, lots of books, lots of stories. And enjoy your birding, everybody in Australia. I'll be there one day.
So thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that chat. And if you tune in again in a day or maybe two, depending on what time I release this, we will have the second chapter of our chat with Adrian Walsh, which will be great. Until then, for the next 24 hours, 48 hours, happy birding.